quite happy to see the turnout. I didn't expect to have that many. Had I known, I was actually going to not even have seats here today. That would have been a real disaster. I didn't have these seats, but I'm really happy that you're there. Even with that, we clearly have a more than full house. So I hope no college official can check up on us in the next hour or so. So my name is Tony Toniato. I'm the director of the Buddhism, Psychology, and Mental Health undergraduate program here at U of T. And also, with another one of my hats, the president of the Nalanda College of Buddhist Studies. And both of us, the Buddhism Minor Program and the college, are sponsoring Asian Rob's talk here tonight. What I'm going to do, I think the way we'll proceed is we're going to introduce him briefly for those of you who don't know him. A lot of my students are right here this evening. You can see them sitting here. And for my students who are going to be letting me know they're here for the signing purpose, you need to let me know that you're here by signing at the end, Lindsay. April, have you? And if for some reason you can't, you'll let me know later tonight. What we'll do is I'll introduce Asian Rama, then he's going to speak for about 45 minutes on a topic that's close to our heart in the program here on the relationship between Buddhism, psychology, and science, which is kind of the philosophy behind the program we have here, which consists of about 10 courses right now dedicated to the study of Buddhism as a way of life and psychology as a philosophy and its interaction with science. After the talk, I think we're going to have a book signing here and some books as well. And possibly some of you want to even, if there's time, to chat with Asian Rama at the end of the afternoon, have a little time. So I think that's how we'll do it. If those of you need to leave earlier, there is an exit right at the back. At the end, there is an exit that goes directly out if you don't want to come back to the front and show us that you're leaving. So, so let me give you a little bit of introduction to our guest tonight and the amazing honor we have having him speak to the university community and many, many people who are here from, I guess, from the Sangha here in Toronto where as you browse, we've conducted a retreat the last couple of days. His full name, Asian Brahmabhamso Mahathera, lovingly known as Asian Brahm, was born Peter Betts in London, UK, a few years ago. He came from a working class background and won a scholarship to study theoretical physics at Cambridge in the late 60s. After graduating from Cambridge, he taught in high school for a while, then traveled to Thailand and became a monk there and trained with the Venerable Ajahn Chah Buddhayana Mahathera. While still as a young monk, a junior monk, he was invited to Perth, Australia by the Buddhist Society of Western Australia to assist Ajahn Jigaro to teach there, initially a very modest astronomy, and eventually developing a very, very extensive monastery, Buddhayana Monastery, named after the teacher, Ajahn Chah Buddhayana. Bodhinyana was become the first dedicated Buddhist monastery in the Southern Hemisphere and is today the largest community of Theravadan Buddhist monks in Australia. For those of you who are in my course, you know that the Buddhism that we study is Theravadan Buddhism primarily. In 1984, a few years ago, Ajahn Brahm became took charge of the monastery and obviously discovered a very, very great skill in teaching and developing a series of teachings and began to speak at a variety of international Buddhist events and conferences throughout the world. And obviously gained considerable notoriety.
Yeah, that's good.
A teacher of Dharma. At the same time, and not neglecting his work with the sick and dying, people in prison, were ill, as well as wanting to meditate, and his own song, of course, as well. Currently, he is the abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine, Western Australia. He's the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, as well as the spiritual advisor to the Buddhist Society of Victoria, spiritual advisor to the Buddhist Society of South Australia, and the spiritual patron of the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. He's written two books, I think both of them are here tonight, including Opening the Door to the Heart.
Five or six, I think.
Okay, we have two here that have expounded on his teachings. And he has hundreds of many talks, either as video or digital format, that are available on his website, which is www.asianbrown.org. So that gives you a little bit of the unique situation we have to have this amazing individual speak to us tonight about the Dharma and its relationship to Buddhism and science. So at this point, I'm going to invite Jivaka to give us his wisdom.
Thank you, Tony. Now, first of all, I think I am uniquely positioned to talk on this subject because I have been a Buddhist monk for almost 40 years now, and I know my Buddhism very well. That's why I teach it extensively all over the world. But also, I had my background in theoretical physics at Cambridge. That was my love, and I still keep in contact with the physicists, you know, throughout the world. I haven't dropped that at all. And I like telling people that a few years ago, Sir Roger Penrose came through town, and of course I was invited to have dinner with him, with the other professors of physics, sitting next to someone from NASA, and still being able to keep that contact. For those of you who don't know, Sir Roger Penrose was a fellow who found or developed the theory for black holes. He's one of the most famous physicists in our world. So I still keep in contact with that physics, but I also developed not only a knowledge, a scholastic knowledge of Buddhism, but also a knowledge of the deeper states of meditation. And on top of that, I spent a lot of my time talking at psychology conferences as well, because the interface between Buddhism and psychology is a growth field in the subject, so much so that there is Buddhist psychology throughout the world. Now, to give you an example of that, when I was teaching in Malaysia last year, a fellow came up to me to tell me that he came from a very wealthy family. If you're wealthy in the East, my goodness, you are wealthy. And he was so wealthy that when he had some problems in his life, he made an appointment with Joseph Sin, the fellow who started cognitive behavioral stress management or stress therapy. And he also booked him to the Mayo Clinic, where all the famous rich and pop stars and film stars go when they're in trouble. You could afford that. But then he told me, he said, when I talked to Zin, he said he was a Buddhist. And when I went to the Mayo Clinic, all of the clinicians, they were also Buddhist. And they were telling me just what I hear in this temple every day. I could have saved a lot of money by just staying at home and listening to monks like you. And indeed, you are listening to the source of that psychology. So you're also saving yourself a lot of money. You don't need to check in to these expensive places. So that's why people actually ask monks all these questions, because we're cheap. Well, you also know what we're talking about. So the interface between Buddhism, psychology, and science, especially physics, I will start off, those of you who are here beginning, you'll find that real physics and science should not be traditional, should always be challenging. One of the founders of modern science, a fellow called Roger Bacon, he was a founder of the Royal Society in England. And if you become an FRS, a fellow of the Royal Society, you are in the elite group of scientists in Europe. He started his Royal Society, but he also laid the foundations of science, saying what real science is you make your hypothesis, and then you try your damnedest to disprove it. Modern science these days, you have a hypothesis, you don't try and challenge it, you try and give it supportive evidence. The reason is because in modern science is driven by the need for grants, research grants. I love citing the recent discovery of the Higgs boson. If you look at deeply at the evidence for the existence of the Higgs boson, it is still very tentative. It has not been demonstrated conclusively that it exists. The evidence is just suggestive. But of course, those thousands of scientists who spend literally billions trying to find this Higgs boson in science, they have to come up with something to justify that huge expense. There is a bias in science, driven by research grants, to take what most people would say is suggestive and to say it's been proven. The burden of proof is not that rigorous when you want to discover something so bad because you spent so many years trying to find it. Where's religion? The burden of proof in today's society is huge. People say, you guys believe in rebirth, prove it. The evidence is there. The evidence for rebirth is much stronger than the evidence for the Higgs boson. But will people actually accept that? No, because we don't want to believe in rebirth. But we really want to find out the Higgs boson. In religion, you don't have peer review. In religion, your statements are reviewed by everybody. By scientists, by atheists, by philosophers, by sociologists, just by the ordinary people on the street. You're reviewed. So you really have to know what you're saying and prove it. In science, we call it peer review. And scientists say, we must be correct because all of our findings are reviewed by our peers, by fellow scientists. That's just like saying, when the Canadian police force is doing something wrong, it's peer reviewed. In other words, you ask other policemen to find out whether these policemen are telling the truth or not. Internal reviews never work. It's like asking banks to self-regulate. So straight away, I want to destroy that authenticity, that justification which science often makes. Oh, it's peer-reviewed, it must be right. It's like to say, oh, the bank, we did the internal review, we weren't responsible for the GFC, it was somebody else's fault. Would you believe that? You have to have external review, not by your peers, by other people who can look at all these statements in a totally different way. I am iconoclastic, especially with science. So much so, I remember on the laboratory, the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, the old one, it was a wonderful place to learn your science because you were taking around this warren of rooms where you imagine some mad scientist had been holed up for years on some weird project. And indeed, they showed you, this is the room where lasers were discovered. This is the room, you know, where Rutherford split the atom. This is a room, you know, where the genetic code was found by, you know, Watson and what's the other guy's name? I've forgotten. Crick and Watson. And that whole history. It was an incredible place to walk through and work. I once went into the tea room in the Cavendish, where all the professors would meet every morning and afternoon for a cup of tea. It was mandatory, no matter who you were, to go into that tea room and have cups of tea. Because on the tables were all clear formica, and they had felt-tip pens. And there, over a cup of tea, you'd write out your equation, and your friends would criticize you. And then you'd actually make your breakthroughs over a cup of tea in the tea room of the Cavendish. I'm sure that many of those old fat tea ladies were Russian spies. That was just me sort of exaggerating things. But on the walls of that great laboratory, someone had scrawled this graffiti. And I will always remember this. The eminence of a great scientist is measured by the length of time they obstruct progress in their field. The more eminent they are, the more they stop innovation. And that's one of the troubles of science. It's also one of the troubles of religion. When you have leaders and authority figures, they stop you finding out the truth. Never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. That's how you've got to be iconoclastic. That was the science I learned at university. Iconoclastic, challenge everybody. And the scientists I knew, would accept that. They welcome the little, you know, wet-nosed students coming up and challenging them the whole way. because they knew that the original science was having to be challenged. Put up your hypothesis and challenge it to bits. That's also what I liked about Buddhism. Real Buddhism, not maybe the traditional stuff you hear about, is always open for challenge. That's why it's very easy for me, part of my biography, which I'm very proud of, was being expelled from the monastery where I grew up. Why? For opening the door to female monastics and giving them ordination in Australia. Now, to me, that is real Buddhism. Going according to the tradition, say it can't be done. It can be done. I know many of the Western monks, they all respect my knowledge of the Vinaya. I'm not just sort of a meditator, I know my stuff and can argue the pants off, because monks don't wear pants. I argue the robe off anybody. I know what I'm talking about. And so it is possible to do that. So straight away, where real science, where real Buddhism, and where psychology meet, is only iconoclasticism. Seeing things new, breaking down old ideas. Religion should be rebellious. It should not allow people to think the same old ways, but should challenge you again and again and again. That's one of the great things I learned from physics, which I took with me as a monk. It was a seamless transition from the laboratories of the Cavendish in Cambridge to the forest of Thailand. All you were doing is finding out the truth. First of all, from the outside in science to the inside in Buddhism and also psychology. And to find out that truth, you had to have those hypotheses, you had to challenge them. Everything was open to challenge. One of the greatest things I respected in Buddhism was a story where the Buddha was giving a teaching and he asked his number one disciple, Sariputta, "Do you believe what I've just said?" And Sariputta said, "No, I don't believe it." Well done for not believing it. Why don't you believe it? Because I haven't experienced that. I don't know. And that was the standard of Buddhism. Don't just believe it because you hear it from some master. If you don't know it, if you haven't experienced it, say you don't believe. That freedom not to believe, the freedom to object, was what I learnt in science, and which is what I respected in Buddhism. This was not a religion for sheep. If you want to be a sheep, go to Australia. This is a religion for people who are intelligent, who can question, who can challenge. Challenge to the max. Just like science should be. And that's where we get the innovation. Whether it's the Buddha, he was a radical. He was not accepted at that time by most people. He was changing things. If you look at the great scientists, they were always rejected when they first put forth their theories. It can't be true. But they stick to those theories and eventually people begin to accept it. This is the radical part of life. And same with psychology. Do not accept what Professor Tony tells you. Challenge it. So let's start with a bit of psychology, which, you know, is one of my bugbears, my missions. Mindfulness based therapy. Okay, but does not go far enough. Just being aware of what you're thinking or what you're feeling. It just comes from the Burmese tradition of vipassana, which is only half of what's really happening. To really understand, to really actually solve these problems in the body and the mind, you should add the magic ingredient of compassion. Not just mindful, but be compassionate as well, be kind. I like to tell the story, this is a funny story, about the mindfulness tradition and how it doesn't work. About a woman who came to listen to my talk, who came from a very wealthy home. Those of you who've been on my retreat heard this story. This woman came from a very wealthy home, which had a guard on the gate. And she told the guard, "Guard, I'm going to the temple this evening to listen to a talk. Please be mindful. There are thieves in the area, burglars, and I don't want them to come into my house when I'm gone. Please be mindful." And the guard said, "Yes, ma'am, I'll be mindful." When she went home after the talk, she found her house had been burgled and many valuable things were missing. So she scolded the guard. "Guard, I told you to be mindful." "I was mindful, madam." "I saw burglars going in. I saw noted burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw your jewelry going out. I was mindful. I watched jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I saw the burglars going in again. I noted burglar going back in. I saw safe coming out, safe going out, safe going out. I was mindful all the time, madam, just as you told me." And I say that because mindfulness is not enough. Mindfulness and kindness is enough. I teach many psychologists in Australia. And whenever I give them the teachings, they scribble them down. And many psychologists say that some of my stories are the key things they use in their practical work in clinical psychology, which actually heals people. Mindfulness and compassion. Here's story number one. So this is not just going to be a lecture. You're going to be able to take something home with you which you can use, whether you're a psychologist or a scientist or whatever. It's called The Monster Who Came Into the Emperor's Palace. There was an emperor who was away on some business. And while he was away, this monster, this frightening demon, came into the palace and walked right into the emperor's throne room. Now all the guards and the soldiers and the ministers who should be defending the place, they froze in terror, allowing the monster to go right into the emperor's throne and sit on it. And as soon as the monster sat on the chair, the guards came to their senses. "Get out of here! Who do you think you are? You're not supposed to sit in here. Get out!" Now those few angry words, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and his language got worse. The soldiers took out their swords and clubs. "If you don't get out quick, we'll carve your butt out of that seat." At every angry word, every angry deed, even angry thoughts, the monster just grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more frightening, more smelly, more offensive. That had been going on a long while when the emperor came back. When the emperor came back, he saw this huge monster taking up half the hall. And he was so frightening, so ugly, it made the alien look like a pussycat. Have you ever seen the Alien movie? It's supposed to be the most frightening monster ever. That's nothing compared to this monster. And the smell, the stench coming off that monster's flesh, even made the maggots throw up. Even the maggots could stand it. And the language. The language was worse than you'd hear in Toronto after Canada lost, what's a hockey cup called, to the United States? Stanley Cup. They lost the Stanley Cup to some team in the US. The language was much worse. But the emperor, he was an emperor because he was smart. He knew what to do. He looked at that frightening, ugly, stinky monster and said, "Welcome. Thank you so much for coming to visit. Has anyone got your cup of tea yet? We've got nice Sri Lankan tea with condensed milk. It's very bad for your health, but it's delicious. Or would you prefer some peppermint?" And of those few kind words, the monster shrank an inch, got less smelly, less ugly, less offensive. And everybody realized their mistake. So they started looking after that monster. 5 people went onto each foot to give him a foot massage. Have you ever had a foot massage, reflexology? It feels so nice. And I say, "Just that bit over there, just a bit to the left. Ooh, that's so nice, thank you." Someone massage his shoulders with a big head like that on, you're going to have neck pain. Somebody asked me, "What's the pizza?" Monster size, of course. And they looked after that monster so well that every kind act, deed or thought, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And soon he was back to the size when he first came in. But they never stopped. They were so kind that soon that monster was so small that one more act of kindness and the monster vanished. The Buddha told that story in the Udana. He didn't mention about the foot massage and the pizza. That did actually come from me, I admit that. When you get a story, always take it in your own way. Nick elaborates it. But the Buddha called that an anger-eating demon who feeds on anger and ill will. Get out of here. You don't belong. Do you recognize anger-eating demons in psychology? Get out of here. You don't belong. You say to your schizophrenia. Get out of here, you don't belong, you say to your depression. Get out of here, you don't belong, you say to your anxiety. These are examples of anger-eating demons. They get worse. I think all of you have enough understanding of the way your mind works to recognize this is a great truth. So instead, you try Buddhist psychology. Welcome, depression. Thank you for being here. Welcome, schizophrenia. Welcome, anxiety. When you don't get anxious at the anxiety, you destroy the negative feedback loop which keeps it growing and growing and growing. I'm not just saying that because of theory. I've taught that, practiced it, and many other people teach it too. It is highly effective. Why? Because you're not just being mindful, you're being compassionate as well. For those studying psychology, here's example number two. It's one of my disciples, so this is a wonderful little anecdote, Jippy. She was the daughter of Thai family who migrated to Perth. Actually a Thai girl married to an Australian guy. She called me from Adelaide University, where she was studying dentistry. She had severe depression and anxiety attacks, paranoia. Depression and paranoia often go together. It was so bad that the university doctors and psychologists could not help her. She was bedridden, too afraid to go out of the bedroom door. And she was very fortunate to have a boyfriend. Her boyfriend was one of these very rare guys who would stick by her, wash her clothes, feed her, and help her in all things. If you ever find a boy like that, keep him. They're very, very rare. And her next piece of good luck was her uncle was a close disciple of mine. So he told this girl, called Ajahn Brahm, so she called me in Perth from Adelaide, which is a long way away, told me her condition. And so my first question to her, when you have an anxiety attack, where do you feel it in your body? She said, I don't know. I said, give me a call in 3 or 4 days' time and you'll find out. Straight away, as anyone who practices psychology in the clinical situation knows, you have to include the person in the treatment. You can't just do it for them. You've got to give them some sort of sense of responsibility over their future health. So I gave her a task to do. Where in your body do you feel it? A few days later she called me up and said, whenever I have this anxiety, these panic attacks, I feel it in my chest, just below my breasts. Brilliant, I said. Now what does it feel like? Well, I don't know, it's just anxiety. Give me a call in 3 days when you can give me a description of it. Again, I was giving her a test, something to do. The real reason was I was asking her to be mindful enough of that feeling so she could describe it to another person. After 3 days, 4 days maybe, she gave me a call and she gave me this amazing description of the pain, the feeling she felt in her chest when she had anxiety disorders. She was becoming aware, mindful enough to describe it to me over the phone. Brilliant. Now your next stage of this therapy is next time you have that anxiety feeling in your stomach, you've got to know it, take your hand and massage it with as much compassion and kindness as you can possibly do. Give it heaps of love. If you can't do that, Get your boyfriend to massage your stomach for you, your chest. That's what boyfriends are there for. But do it with as much compassion as you can possibly get. And give me a call in 3 or 4 days' time to tell me what happened. In 3 or 4 days' time, she phoned me again and said, yeah, I followed your advice. When I had these recurrent anxiety attacks, I could feel it in my tummy, I called my boyfriend over, I did it myself, I massaged it. What happened to that feeling in your body? It went away. And then I said, what happened to the anxiety? I'll never forget the pause. It was what we call the light bulb moment. She paused and said, the anxiety went too. Brilliant. Now you know how to deal with your anxiety. Every emotional problem, whether it's anger, fear, anxiety, even depression, it does have a corresponding physical feeling in your body. You try and deal with that anxiety in the mental world, you're not capable of doing that. You're not so skilled in the mind, but you certainly are skilled in the body. So find out the physical feeling, know it with mindfulness, add that compassion, and you can compassionately relax that part of the body so the physical manifestation, the counterpart to anxiety in your body, disappears. And with it, surprise, surprise, so does the mental part. Within a few weeks, she was out of bed. She went back to university. She got first class honours in dentistry. A year later, she insisted that I do the wedding for her and her husband, Lloyd. The guy who looked after her and massaged her is now her husband. At the time, she was so impressed with that therapy that she nominated me for Australian of the Year. I never got that award, but I was very, very proud that she thought so much of me that she nominated me. That is a true story, and I like to repeat that because it shows how mindfulness and compassion does the job for you. If ever you feel afraid, you're going to an examination, or you're going to an interview for a job, or you're about to speak in public, whatever else is causes of anxiety and fear in your world, don't try and attack that emotional feeling with your mind. It will have a counterpart physical feeling. Know that with mindfulness, deal with it with compassion, and you find you can relax it totally away, and the problem is gone. Not just once, but you know how to deal with it in the future. You are now in control of your mental health. Well done. Now this is cutting edge psychology. I don't have time to do clinical trials. These are all anecdotal, but it shows you a way you can find more innovation into mindfulness-based stress reduction or anxiety reduction by adding the better ingredient of kindness. And my goodness, it works. The two together. So you never stop at repeating old people's ideas. You take it further. And I'm sure that later on you can add something else which makes the therapy even more effective than what I've just taught you. Don't just be people who repeat. Take it further, innovate, and allow these things to grow. So this is where Buddhism and psychology, they really help one another. Why is that? Because monks who meditate, we spend all our life looking at our minds, understanding how it works. And we have these incredible source of amazing techniques. Mindfulness and compassion also helps you with your physical health. And I told a story about 2 years ago, personal story, when I had, food poisoning. Because monks are fed by their supporters in Theravada, we don't really know where the food you put into our plates and bowls comes from. It arrives in the temple, we eat it, and sometimes we really should have food tasters before we eat. This time, it was some dirty food, and I got food poisoning. If you had food poisoning, it was acute and very strong. I was in my room, literally rolling on the floor, holding my belly in agony. It was really too far away from the hospital. I don't like going to hospitals anyway. Somebody once told me, I know there's a lot of doctors here, but somebody once told me, if you want to be sick, go go and see a doctor. If you want to die, go to hospital. If you don't believe me, in Jerusalem, a few years ago, I got the article in Perth, I can actually email it to you. In Jerusalem and Perth, the doctors went on strike for 2 weeks. There was some sort of dispute about something or other, conditions or pay. And during the time the doctors were not working in the hospitals in Jerusalem, the death rate plummeted. Not as many people died during those 2 or 3 weeks. Doesn't that tell you something? Anyway, back to my food poisoning. Of course, rolling around in agony like a stupid monk, you know, we're all hypocrites to some degree, and then you start thinking, what would I tell other people to do? And then I started practicing what I preach, being mindful of that agony. Don't try and get rid of it, just be aware of it. And then add kindness. What mindfulness does in your treatment in psychology, it gives you feedback. You can see whether that pain is getting worse or getting better. You're aware, just like in science. You see, when you do this, what happens? When you do something else, what happens? Now, the instruments in your laboratory give you that data called feedback. So my feedback was created by mindfulness. That was my meter. And I found out when I was kind to that pain, the pain got less. So I carried on with compassion, it got less. More compassion, got less. The mindfulness was telling me I was going in the correct direction. It took me just 20 minutes, and this is no exaggeration, that pain vanished completely. I was up and about, no pain, no agony, no food poisoning. I do know enough about science, that's impossible, but that's true. What happened to the bacteria, or the whatever? I don't know what happened to it, but it was gone. Never underestimate the power of mindfulness and compassion coming together. Of course, people say, okay, come on, you know, you have to replicate the results. Okay, you go and get food poisoning, I'll give you some dirty food. Yeah, it does work. So, you know, there is the hypothesis. You guys in hospital, go and prove it. Oh, in university. Out of compassion, you'll find you will take the research into Buddhism and psychology to that next level. And it does work. Try it, see if it does. And even in science, basic Buddhism and science, yes, we do argue. Buddhism tries to keep science honest, and science should keep Buddhism honest. That interface between those two great traditions should be beneficial to both, but it's a give and take. When Buddhism engages with science, we're going to destroy some of your privileged misconceptions. You're going to lose something, you're going to have to think again. And many parts of Buddhism will have to think again too. And I love that. Never allow your learning or traditions to stand in the way of truth. Some years ago, I made the statement, there are two types of religion in this world, and this includes science. The first religion will bend the truth to fit the faith. The other one bends the faith to fit the truth. It doesn't matter if it's Buddhism, science, Christianity, Islam, whatever. You all know examples when people bend the truth to fit their faith. This can't be true, because my faith doesn't allow it. In fact, if it's true, if the data are there, you've got to amend your faith, even when that's physics and science. Science has become the latest dogmatic belief system, when it can't be true that things travel faster than the speed of light. You all know one case where it does, quantum pairing. Something happens to one particle in one part of the universe, the corresponding particle which is basically originated together, I'm not saying created because that gives a creator, originated. Don't say creation of the universe, originating of the universe. When you say creation of the universe and creatures, you're implying there is some mechanism or being which made these things. Origination is a much more neutral word. So don't say creation of the world or creation of speech or creation of anything. Origination is a much better. So when these particles originated, somehow or other they have a connection, a pairing. When something happens to one particle in one part of the universe, the other particle is affected. Somehow or other information goes across, breaking one of the core principles of science. Brilliant. That's what science is there for, to challenge, to upset, to take understanding further. It bends your mind, isn't it? One of the greatest parts of science, quantum physics, that's what I actually learned from Cambridge, is actually that these things which seem impossible is just because your imagination has not gone far enough. Your worldview needs to be expanded. You have assumptions you haven't seen which need to be thrown aside so you can see a wider picture. That's why there are some quotes of Albert Einstein say, imagination is more important than knowledge. Or something like that. I remember seeing it on a poster of his recently.
That's it.
Oh great, I've got a good memory. Imagination. Expand your framework for understanding. Take it further. And one thing which started to do that with me was the great Schrodinger's cat experiment. It's famous. Most people denied it's possible. But now it became part of what's called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics. It lost ground some time ago, but it's making its resurgence. It's one of the best ways of understanding quantum physics. And that interpretation, mostly forged by Niels Bohr, who was at in Copenhagen, that's where he lived. It was the experiment, not actually done, but just a thought experiment, of putting a cat in a box, sealed box. And in that box is a cyanide capsule, which if it broke, would kill that cat instantaneously. And the breaking of that capsule was linked to a quantum process, the decay of the cesium atom. Arranged so there's a 50-50 chance that after, say, 10 minutes, the cesium atom will decay enough to break the capsule and the cat will be killed. So after 10 minutes, there's a 50-50 chance of the cat being killed or alive. Before you open the box, was the cat alive? Was the cat dead? Quantum physics proved conclusively the cat was neither dead nor alive, but was in a third state, the quantum improbability. When you start thinking about that, that is impossible. A cat is either dead or alive. Ask the cat. But you can't ask the cat. The cat's in the box. It's unable to be observed yet. The reality is, the truth is much different than we could imagine. The cat is neither alive nor dead. That third possibility is a true one. And the only reason why you can't accept that, because you haven't expanded your mental world enough to accept that possibility. You're limited. You're like the flat earthers who for many years just couldn't comprehend this world could be round. You couldn't see that. In the same way, our perceptions and understanding is so limited that we find it difficult to accept what is perfectly true. Real science expands your imagination like Einstein asked you to do. The same as Buddhism does. Expand what you could ever think to be true and not just to stand on old ideas. Break them down. See things anew. There's a lot of work being done in psychology on the nature of the will. You all know the will, don't you? Absolutely not. You assume you know this thing which caused you to come here this evening. You assume that you're in control of that. No, you are not. One of the societies I joined at Cambridge was a psychic research society. I was always interested in weird things. That was a natural adaptation from physics to find out all this supernatural stuff which people say, is it real or is it false? So a lot of my friends were into supernatural stuff as well. I wonder if, is there something there? So one of the experiments, not experiments, the lectures, sorry, which was done every year, was getting a hypnotist to come and do a demonstration in front of the students. Now, you're students, as a student, you know what you're like, you're willing to volunteer for anything. If you make a fool of yourself, who cares, that's what you do as a student anyway in the bar. So, I volunteered, other people volunteered, I was not a good hypnotic subject. But there's always, every year, there's one student was always easily hypnotized. And of course, you know, the demonstration was making them do stupid things. It was entertainment, but also something important as well. So they got the student to take down their trousers, top on their head, whatever it was stupid, which made adolescent young men laugh. But then the hypnotist said to this hypnotized student, later on, when I touch my right earlobe, I want you to stand up, no matter what I'm saying or what's happening, I want you to stand up immediately and sing the British National Anthem in a loud voice. Now I'm taking you out of hypnosis. You won't remember what I've told you, but when I touch my right ear, you stand up and sing the National Anthem. As a member of the audience, I saw that, as did all my friends. When that boy went back to his seat, we were waiting for the hypnotist to touch his right earlobe. He was a great entertainer because he would sometimes get close and then scratch his cheek. You know, keeping us interested. But then finally he touched his right earlobe. And this student stood up and sang the British National Anthem in front of all these other students who were peeing themselves laughing. It was such a funny thing. We were roaring. Did that stop him or embarrass him? Not at all. He carried on to the end of the British National Anthem. When we all stopped laughing, we got the reason why the hypnotist said this. He asked the student, why did you sing the British National Anthem? And the student gave a reason. He convinced me and everybody else that that student was under the impression he freely chose to sing the National Anthem. We all know it was not his free choice. You've been hypnotized, conditioned to sing that. And that was the first time I started to doubt my own will. How much of what you choose to do comes from you? How much of it comes from someone else? Are you really a free agent? That's fundamental to your existence and how you behave. How much are you conditioned? When you get into meditation, which is the experiment which Buddhism does, that's our lab. That's our main way of finding out things, by sitting down, making the mind so still that things disappear. Your body vanishes. The five senses stop. You can just be there with that sixth sense. In science, how many senses have we? They only say five. We're supposed to have our philosophy from the Greeks. If you read Aristotle, there was always six senses from Aristotle. The five senses plus the mind is number six. Aristotle called that the common sense, because what you see with your eyes, hear with your ears, smell, taste and touch with your body, the mind knows. The mind is common to all those five senses. Somewhere over the last 2,200 years, Western science has lost its mind and misplaced its common sense. He said the mind doesn't exist anymore as a sense. Aristotle knew better, so do Buddhists, because you do the experiment of meditation, your five senses vanish. You can't see, hear, smell, taste, touch. I've given many examples in the retreat of that. You experience that for yourself. The only thing left is that sixth sense, the mind. You come face to face with it, you can do experiments with it, you get to know it. One of the things you get to know, your mind has nothing to do with your body or your brain. This is something which challenges many thousands of neuroscientists who are still trying to find out the origin of consciousness, including Sir Roger Penrose, who has this crazy idea. It's good to have a hypothesis, fine, but it's very easy to be disproved that the mitochondria have something to do with the source of consciousness and one idea of self and knowing. No way. The reason is, when you get into those deep states of meditation, your brain stops. There's no activity left in your brain. The other time the brain stops is called death. Professor Pim van Rommel was one of the first people who started research into near-death experiences. I love challenging scientists on this to show how unscientific they are. You make a proposition, they reject it because their imagination is not wide enough to accept the possibility of a mind being separate from the brain. Put the hypothesis down now, please disprove it. One of the classic near-death experiences. How do you have a couple? A person, an operating table, it mostly happens, floated out of their body in an operating table, floated high above their body. And you can say, well, what they experience then, what they see and hear. You know, maybe it's, you know, they get that just from the dysfunctional state of the brain just prior to death. You know, when it's flooded with so many chemicals, you don't know what's happening. But this particular case, the person floated high above their body, and when they came back again, they said that on the windowsill of one of the high windows was a tennis shoe. This was not something you could anticipate. And in fact, the doctors and nurses said, impossible. We have to keep operating theatres so hygienic, there's no way you can have a tennis shoe on the ledge of this high window. And those old operating tables, you had to have some light, so you had the windows very high, just to let in some light, but not so people could look through them. So standing up in the operating theatre, you could not see what was on that shelf. The person insisted it was there, and of course someone got a ladder, and it was there. That's a classic case of someone being able to perceive something which you just cannot perceive, standing up in the operating table, which no one knew was there, which shouldn't have been there. It was anomalous. A classic case of these near-death experiences showing you are perceiving, and you can remember, things which you should be able to see and perceive with your brain, your eyes, your ears, or anything else. But the other classic case was, because this was controversial, there was an anaesthetist who was a fellow researcher with Peter Fenwick, Professor Peter Fenwick of Southampton University, also researching these near-death experiences, who found this important case which could maybe prove once and for all that these near-death experiences are real, they're not some byproduct of brain dysfunction, which would actually show that the mind, consciousness, observation is independent of the brain. A lady who had an aneurysm at the base of her brain, which no one was prepared to operate on because it was just too dangerous, they didn't know how to do this. If not operating, it was only a matter of time when that aneurysm burst, you would die. She had nothing to lose by trying a new procedure, cryogenic freezing. They took her body temperature so low that everything stopped. They drained the blood out of her as well. And literally took the brain out from the cavity of the skull to get underneath it to fix the aneurysm. Literally put the brain back again, put on the top of the skull, warm her up, and hope for the best. She gave her permission because she had nothing to lose. She would not sue the hospital or the doctors if she didn't make it. Of course, she did make it. The anaesthetist was waiting if there was any near-death experience, so she could actually record what was being said, see if it was accurate. And of course, many of the things which she said actually happened. And the point was, the anaesthetist was looking to see if there was any possibility of brain activity. There was none at all at a time when she could see and hear what was being said and done. I tell scientists that, and they continue to refuse to believe. They increase the burden of proof on such things, which they were never asked for in, say, Higgs boson. Because they don't want to believe it, because it's challenging, the burden of proof gets risen to impossible levels. That is unscientific. The same burden of proof for other research done in science should also apply to such things as NDEs. The reason is because that starts to prove that there is something which happens after death. It is not the end of things, and that is incredibly important for our culture and our society to learn. It's much more important than finding a Higgs boson, because that opens up the whole idea of things like rebirth. If the thing called the mind can survive the death of the body, we go into a new dimension. Rebirth becomes possible. Other things become possible too. The whole spirituality starts to have more meaning. I know that religion has challenged, science has challenged religion. Now religion is challenging science. Disprove that, please. Once we have an idea, the mind continues on. This mental process, we have a much better idea of what this thing called a mind is. I'm going to maybe finish the 12 questions. One of my friends from Cambridge, he wrote a letter to me once he got married and had kids. His 5-year-old daughter in grade 1 at school was asked a question by the teacher. What's the biggest thing in the world? One kid put their hand up, only 5 years old, my daddy. Very sweet, that's what a kid says. Another kid had just been to the zoo, an elephant is the biggest thing in the world, I'm an elephant. Another kid said, a mountain! They're getting much better. And the daughter of my friend, who is now doing postgrad work in biochemistry in Oxford, just shows that she was born brilliant. She put up her hand and said, Miss, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. And the teacher, what do you mean? He said, well, my eye can see her daddy, an elephant, and a mountain, and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. Please argue against that. Disprove it. All she's doing is changing the perceptual framework. And what she says is legitimate. But when I heard that, I said 99%, but not 100%. Because your mind can see everything your eye can see. And it can imagine things you will never see in this real world. Your mind can also hear, smell, taste, and touch real and imaginary things. It also has its own area of knowledge. It can know anger, it can know love, it can know fear. In fact, everything you can ever know or experience in this world can fit into your mind. So the mind is the biggest thing. I haven't said in the world, because the world can fit into your mind. I've said that for so many years. No one has ever come up with an argument against it. It's just looking at things in a different framework, expanding your imagination to see a better truth. When you understand your mind is the biggest thing in the whole world, the biggest thing, the world is in the mind, it changes the way you look at things. This is why real knowledge is not just something you write on the blackboard. Real knowledge just changes our world. Have not just technological benefits, but sociological benefits as well. If, especially, I'm not going to say about the present election, if Mr. George W. Bush had understood he'd get reincarnated in his next life, probably in Iraq, he would not have invaded the place. If all the present world leaders realize they're going to have to come back and live on this earth again, they would take much better environmental care of this world. Most of our leaders and decision makers are old. They're out of here soon. Global warming, sea level rise won't affect them. Or will it? If they realize they can get born again and live in this world again, they take much better care of this earth. It has many, many consequences. That's why I push this, as where Buddhism meets psychology and challenges science. And science also challenges Buddhism. As I said earlier, some of the things which Buddhism says are totally off the wall and should be discarded. Things which even traditional Buddhists believe about the nature of the Buddha, supposed to be three times the size of a normal being. If you look at the pictures of the Buddha, he's got this big bump on his head. You know, in medicine, what would that be? He had some tumor or something, some weird fellow. All that stuff, come on, be real, you don't have to believe that. So that sort of stuff in Buddhism, please throw it away. All the superstition. And I know there's some Chinese Buddhists here. Have you ever gone to the temple, for example, and seen people praying, shaking incense in the temples? You know where that comes from? Where that comes from is tradition in Asia for the grandmother to take the children to the temple for the first time. And often the grandmother takes the children every day or every week to the temple. When grandmother puts the incense into the big bowl, the reason she shakes is because she's got Parkinson's. And the children think, oh, I must follow grandmother. So the children started following that. Now everyone else starts to follow that. It just came because one or two grandmothers had Parkinson's, and now you think that's what you have to do. You ask any Chinese Buddhist, why do they? I don't know why we do that, just grandma did that. Please don't be superstitious. But also don't reject traditions either. Have a look. Is there something there? Is there some reason behind this? If not, throw it away. If there is, keep it. Be iconoclastic, just like science should be. I've gone on for a while now, so please now challenge me. That's my hypothesis, now please tear it apart. Yes, sir. Okay, we're just going to get this thing.
Mr. Rajan, there is something that came to my mind when you were saying that you can actually change the meaning of the things in your mind when you are at that level of conscience or meditation. At that level, your mind is zero. You're mentally not, your mind is not working.
I know your mind is working, but your sight, sound, taste, touch has been turned off. You've got one sense left. Your mind.
Okay, the question was, if I want to change something in my mind, should I go to that point?
You don't need to go to that mind. Sometimes just understanding your will is conditioned. You call it brainwashing. You call it therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. Just self-hypnosis. These are all ways of changing the mind. You put new programming into your mind. It's not that hard to do. You all know, at least if you haven't done this experiment before, do it tonight. When you go to bed tonight, you're tucked in bed, about to go to sleep. Before you go to sleep, maybe have to get up 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. Set your alarm clock to 5 past 6, so you're not afraid. And tell yourself, I will wake up at 6 o'clock, I will wake up at 6 o'clock, I will wake up at 6 o'clock. Give that information to your mind. Forget about it, go to sleep. 95% of the time, you will wake up at 6 o'clock, 1 or 2 minutes either side. You're programming your mind. Try that, and you'll find it works. Now, you may have some anxiety about a certain person. Program your mind. When I see that person, I won't be anxious. When I see that person, I won't be anxious. When I see that person, I won't be anxious. Program that into your mind. When you see that person the next time, you'll be amazed. Something will kick in to change that mental habit. You'll have the opportunity of not getting anxious. It's like a voice tells you, don't be anxious, don't be anxious, don't be anxious. You are programming your mind. Old habits are being changed. Old ways of doing things, you can move to another way. That's one way how you can change your mind. The other way is you come to talks by people like me, and I change your mind in the same way that Dr. Tony has changed the way you think by listening to him lecture after lecture after lecture. How the TV changes your mind. You are influenced. The thing which you call your will, in advertising. Advertising says every dollar spent on advertising you get $3 back in return. On average, it works. That's why the advertising industry is so powerful. When you see an advertisement on TV, in the glossy newspapers or whatever, do you follow it? Does it affect you? The trick in advertising is most people think they're far too advanced to be influenced by the stupid ads on TV. If you were above that, and the advertisement did not affect you, there would be no money in it. It does affect you. What you see on the TV, on the advertising boards, is why you buy, why you go to those places, why you buy those cars. It does affect you. You don't realize it. How much you are conditioned by advertising, TV ads about the election, TV ads or programs about fashion. Why do you wear the hair you do? Is it your free choice? No. You have been conditioned. You're a puppet. Yes? No? Challenge that. See if you can do things differently. I challenge all you girls to shave your hair off today. To prove me wrong. Okay, go on, next question.
Hi, I just have a question. You say that you should throw traditions away if it's not useful or if it's not beneficial for us. Then why are you wearing the robe?
It's because I've got no other clothes, so it's either this robe or nothing. Please take your choice. It's also useful because it singles me out as a monk, just like a policeman wears his clothes, because you know what a policeman is, like a fireman wears a uniform, like people in labs wear white coats, not green coats, because you know this is a person working in a lab. It serves a purpose. I often say that, say the Christian church, you don't know who's a priest and who's an ordinary person. They don't even wear a dog collar anymore. You don't know who they are. Sometimes they just wear a little cross on the lapel, which you can't see anyway. And sometimes people need to access the priests or whatever, just like you need to go and find a doctor. If you don't know who they are or where they are, you never see them. You don't know they exist. It's like you don't know the phone number for the emergency service. So wearing a robe shows you, yes, I'm a monk. Wearing your hair long and a bra shows you a woman. If men wore bras, we wouldn't know who to go out with. Clothes serve a purpose. Okay, question over here. There's two questions. Yeah, come on.
So my question
Oh no, I've got the microphone first, another fellow, and then it comes down to you next.
If you didn't experience something firsthand, then how would you objectively know what is the truth and what is superstitious?
Okay, and seeing something firsthand, we have this, what's it called, theory of knowledge or theory of truth in Buddhism, that if we call them the five hindrances, if those five hindrances are active, basically desire, ill will, restlessness, dullness, or doubt, if those five hindrances are active, you can't trust what your senses present to the mind. For example, I don't know if that girl sitting next to you is your girlfriend or not. They're looking at each other. Oh, maybe you're in with a chance there, young man. When you fall in love, where do people go in our world for romance? They go to nightclubs, candlelit dinners, or a walk by the lake in the moonlight. Aren't those romantic places? Why are they romantic? What do those three places have in common? Darkness. Because when you're sitting on the other side of a small table with this girlfriend, it's so dark that she does look like Angelina Jolie, Scarlett Johansson, or whoever else you think is hot. The same with him, he looks like Brad Pitt, Justin Bieber, or whatever. It's just the same. Because in the darkness, the distortions of perception have freedom to work their magic. You will never fall in love in midday in the bright sunlight. You see what you want to see. Later on in life, you file for divorce. When you file for divorce, you have such ill will, you can't see anything in that girl. Why did I marry her? You know, what was I thinking about when I made her my girlfriend? She's still got those same wonderful qualities she had all along, and the same flaws. But when you're angry, you can't see anything good in that person. When you have desire, you can't see anything bad. Desire and ill will bend the truth. You cannot trust what you see with desire and ill will. That's why even in science, if you want to find something, you'll find it. You'll distort the data. Put aside those data, those results, which you know, are anomalous. In other words, they don't fit in with what you want to prove. You reject them. If you have ill will, all those data which show that rebirth is a fact, if you don't want to believe it, you reject it. Be careful of what you want and what you don't want. That distorts the truth. So the first thing we do in Buddhist practice is take away all the wants and don't wants, which is a hard thing to do. That's what meditation does. There's no desire, no craving, let go, no ill will. Just seeing the world as it truly is, from a still mind, not distorted. We call that the simile of the lake. If there are ripples on the surface of the lake, it will distort the image of the moon and stars above. Only when that lake is perfectly still, with no movement, no desire, no ill will, nothing happening, only then do you get an accurate image of the moon and stars above. The only thing you can trust is what you see with a still mind. Okay? Another question, yeah? Go on.
Earlier in your speech, you were discussing how compassion helps when you're looking for yourself and dealing with some internal issue. And I was wondering, is there a teaching in Buddhism that deals with a sense of commiseration where you're having a conversation, let's say, with another person, and you can truly empathize and feel their pain? What is that sense in Buddhism, or how does Buddhism deal with
that? And that is compassion, that's karuna, but you've got to be careful sometimes. My mother died in February this year. And people said, oh, that's so sad. What do you mean it's sad? I was very happy she died. She had Alzheimer's for about 3 or 4 years. She was in a prison. Now she was free. We have these conditioned responses. When I say my mother died, I think, oh, you poor thing. What do you mean? You're sad. I'm not sad at all. I'm at peace. I'm happy. Why are you putting your conditioned emotional response on me? So empathize when empathy is asked for. Don't just give it because you feel sad. Now this is a psychology, especially of visiting people in hospital. When you visit your best friend or people you love in hospital, what do you say? How are you feeling today? That's the dumbest, worst question you could ever ask. Of course they're feeling bad. But also, you're reminding them of only one part of their existence, their sickness. If you visit someone in hospital, don't talk to the sickness, talk to the person. They're much more than that. So just tell them the latest joke. And my latest joke, you know, our monastery cat died. And even though a cat has 9 lives, our cat got hit by a truck with 10 wheels.
1, 2, 3. So,
don't always empathize. That's what I do when I go visit people in the hospital. I tell them jokes. And they keep inviting me. Thank you, Ajahn. Look, everyone else talks about my sickness. The doctors and nurses, and then my best friend comes and says, how's your sickness today? I'm sick of my sickness. There's more to me than my illness. So talk about something else. The people in the hospital love you can treat them as normal human beings, not stigmatized by the sickness. Same when people die, that's only part of them. So if you can understand the psychology of empathy, you'll give it when it's needed, not because it's culturally demanded. Okay, yeah?
You said that if you have pain in your body, you first become mindful and then you show compassion to ease that. And you said that you did that for your diarrhea or your food poisoning.
I have diarrhea, I need to walk up.
I can understand that you can be mindful, but can you sort of demonstrate briefly how you become compassionate to it?
A very good question. Again, it was food poisoning. I've done it to many other aches and pains in the body. Actually, you learn what compassion means. Because as you're mindful, if it starts relaxing and the pain lessens off, whatever you've just been doing, that is what compassion is. Everybody assumes they understand what compassion is. It's just one of these things we make assumptions of which aren't true. So just like when you go to see a person in hospital, oh, you poor thing, that is often not compassion. That's not what they really need. That doesn't help the situation. Sometimes it does, but often it doesn't. Automatic response is insensitive to the changing situation in front of you. You're making too many assumptions. So instead, if it's real compassion, everything gets more relaxed, more peaceful, the pain eases. The tension lessens. So your mindfulness shows you what's changing. And if it's becoming more calm, more peaceful, whatever that was, that's what compassion is. And by this process, you learn the meaning of compassion, which is your own personal experience. And then you can identify all those words you thought were compassion. Now you understand where those words come from, what truly is kindness. Kindness is what heals, softens, soothes. That's real kindness. Does that answer your question? You don't think about it, you're aware of it. Are you aware of the feeling in your bottom now on the seat? Can you know that feeling in your bottom?
My mom has a bad arthritis.
Bad arthritis. She's probably afraid of that pain. And will not look at it. If she does look at it, she's looking at it, trying to get rid of it. Remember this simile of the monster in the emperor's palace. Get out of here, arthritis, you don't belong. I don't want you anymore. That makes the arthritis worse. Be mindful, just leave it alone. Relax, and you'll get much less. You're actually changing much of the way you deal with these things. Another question?
So the mind is not the body, it's not the brain. Is it possible for you to describe where the mind is?
Haha, that's the wrong question. Remember, the world is in the mind, not the mind in the world. I'll now prove it to you. Put your right hand up if you feel happy. Now be honest. Put your left hand up if you're unhappy.
Right hand up if you're happy, left hand up if you're unhappy.
Keep your hands up. Now that happiness, with your index finger, can you please point to it for me? Locate it. Where is the happiness? Please, where is it? Can you locate it? The next time you're angry, point to that anger. Where is it located? You cannot locate happiness, love, fear, anxiety, anywhere in your body or anywhere in space. Because these are things which belong to the mental world. In the same that trees and flowers belong in a garden, they don't belong really in your house. There may be some house plants, but trees don't belong in your house. Same with anxiety, fear, happiness, love. They exist in the mind. If you can locate those in your body, then you know where your mind is. When you're in love, it's commonly said you love the whole world. When you're afraid, everything is fearful. Because these locate where the mind is. The world is in your mind. The mind is not located in the world. If you try and find the mind in your brain, in your heart, in the mitochondria, you'll never find it there. It doesn't exist there. These things exist in the mind. Disprove that, please. Okay, three
more questions.
Okay, some over here. Some in the front as well. Okay.
Yes. I try really hard to understand rebirth. And could you just give us like a rebirth 101 here?
Okay, rebirth 101. First of all, we have the evidence for rebirth. The research, the best research done was by Professor Ian Stevenson of Virginia. His research, the methodology was so brilliant, so watertight, you know, with controls, double-blind experiments, the whole works, that it's very hard to refute. There's evidence there of many people who could clearly remember previous lives, have access to information. There's no way they could have got that information from any other source. Look at the works of Professor Ian Stevenson. The evidence is there. Where people object to rebirth, he says, show us the mechanism. How does it work? And I challenge people with a simile of a very common physical law of the law of gravity. We all know and accept the law of gravity is a fundamental principle of physics. Say the moon moves and it affects the tides on planet Earth. We all know the effect, but no physicist to this day has worked out how it works. What sends the information from the moon to the oceans of our world to create tides? People thought it may be the graviton, a particle, like a photon, takes the information of electromagnetic force, light, for example. They've never been able to find any evidence at all of a graviton. One of my friends in the University of West Australia was one of the pioneers in trying to find out gravity waves. For about 10 or 15 years he was looking for them, with some people also, I think, in Japan. Never found anything. Gravity waves, gravitons, they don't exist. Gravity does. We know the effect, we still don't understand how it works. So anyone objects to the law of rebirth, how does it work? You can still understand that later on, but at least you know it does work. And please use the same standards of proof you use for gravity on rebirth. The evidence is there, it does work. It is a real effect. The evidence is compelling. How it works is a different thing. To understand how it works, you have to understand the nature of this thing we call the mind. The brain stops. That can't be reincarnated. Understanding the nature of this thing we call the human mind, you understand how one will conscious moment creates another one, which creates another one, which creates another one. It creates a process driven by craving, by wanting. That drives you through this life, as will drive the mind in a space between births and into a new birth. You carry on because you want to. You want to be, therefore you create new being. To understand that, you can see that with your own mind. Why are you sitting in an auditorium here in Toronto? I don't know where you came from, where you were born. You can see the craving, the wanting, the desire it's driven you. They will continue to drive you, even past your death. That is the mechanism. But you have to do some more research in meditation to actually see that process happen. There is the experiment. It's a personal experiment which you can do in your own mind to see whether this is true or not. But it takes a lot of resources, a lot of time to develop your mind in stillness so you can actually see what this mantra is.
We have time for one more question. I've been thinking about for a long time. Amazing questions, amazing answers.
Yeah.
But one more question is the time for you to
okay, yeah.
Which is both and we talk a little bit personally. You have the honor of the last question.
Okay.
So hi there. for those of us who are sort of new to Buddhism and want to get make some progress emotionally, psychologically, get to a better place over the next few years, what would you say are the first 3, 4, 5 steps to doing that, seeing as we're busy students at U of T, we're working hard 9 to 5.
Okay.
What would be your advice there?
Did you hear all the things I get up to in the beginning here, all the responsibilities I had? I took a 36-hour flight to Toronto, had about 4 hours actually non-sleep, and then we started a retreat. I worked damn hard. When I told a person how hard I worked, somebody said, you know, I always wanted to become a monk until I heard you speak. Now I'm going to stay as an IT programmer. Less stress. This is a simile of the cup. To understand what Buddhism is and how important it is in your life as a student and later on in your life to reduce stress. How heavy is my cup of water? Don't say how many grams, like someone in Imperial College said when I gave this to me a year ago. The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, my arm starts to ache. After 2 minutes, I'm in pain. After 5 minutes, I'm in agony. I'm a very stupid monk. When it starts to get too heavy to hold comfortably, what should I do? Put it down. Don't throw it away. Put it down and rest for 30 seconds. You can try this at home if you don't believe me. After 30 seconds, this is an experiment, you know, just giving you the way to prove and reproduce the results. When I pick it up after 30, it actually feels lighter. It's exactly the same weight of water, but because I've rested, it's easy to carry. All the work you do at this university, all in life, the only reason you get stressed out is because you don't know how to put the burden down for a few minutes to rest. Whatever you're studying, any assignment you're doing, any work you're trying to complete, when you start to feel that it's getting too heavy, put it down and rest for 10 or 15 minutes. Listen to some music, meditate is the best. After 10 or 15 minutes, you pick up the assignment, open up the computer again. Because you have rested, your brain is far more efficient. It gets the assignment done in 1 hour instead of 2, and it's higher quality because you've rested. You are becoming efficient in the use of your brain instead of stupid like most students and people in the offices in business are. They do not know how to use their brain efficiently. When it's time, rest. I first told that, I've been telling that story for a long time. I told it when I gave a keynote at the World Computer Conference in Australia a couple of years ago. From there it went to the Australian National Newspaper, from there it went to the Australian Stock Exchange, and about 6 months ago it was on Harvard Business School blog about how half an hour of rest during lunchtime is an investment for the afternoon. Call it investment and people in business want to listen. What you are doing, half an hour, 5 minutes, 10 minutes of rest, you make that up later on with greater efficiency. This is what Buddhism teaches you, the psychology of the mind. You do not use your brain well, which means your productivity goes down, the quality goes down, and all you need to do is 10 or 15 minutes of rest. Pick up the work afterwards, you get more done, high quality in less time. That's why it is an investment. It works. But you've got to have the confidence and the skill to put things down, to let them go, to stop clinging. And that's what Buddhism teaches you.
Okay, I think we'll take that
okay.
to bring the talk to a close. But just a couple of comments before we show our appreciation. As I was listening to you, what was struck, I hope my students who are here, quite a few of them, have sensed the how much of what you said resonated with how the course is being taught. And a lot of your insights and descriptions are definitely, you know, cutting edge in terms of how psychology looks at things and in the sense of our course. So it was heartening to feel kind of a resonance with you as you spoke about your views and how similar they were to the basic views we talked in the class. So from that point of view, I really felt honored to hear that exposition you gave. And the questions were very excellent. The answers would have been, you know, more enlightening. So I know we could have gone on for a long time, and the questions, and there was quite a few more questions, so maybe some people have a chance to answer them before the evening's over. In the meantime, we'll have a chance to purchase books here and to come to the front here. But to end the evening, let's give Adam an amazing applause.